This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. These violent delights have violent ends, and in their triumph die, like fire and powder, which as they kiss, consume. These Violent Delights is the debut novel by Chloe Gong. At first glance, the book seems like Romeo and Juliet transplanted to 1920s Shanghai. Two rival families, and two main characters, Juliet Tsai and Roma Montagov. But Chloe Gong takes the tropes of Romeo and Juliet and transforms them in ways beyond just the new setting. Juliet and Roma have already had their teenage relationship. An epidemic of madness stalks the population of Shanghai, and there are rumors of a monster in the Huangpu River. These Violent Delights is a thrilling tale of intrigue and investigation, woven with horror and fantasy elements. Chloe Gong is a student of the University of Pennsylvania, studying English and International Relations. During her breaks, she's either at home in New Zealand or visiting her many relatives in Shanghai. Chloe has been known to mysteriously appear when Romeo and Juliet is one of Shakespeare's best plays and doesn't deserve its slander in pop culture is chanted into a mirror three times. Today, Chloe and I will talk about her book, and how the book's elements connect to the setting of 1920s Shanghai. We'll talk about the various ways she works in the tropes of Romeo and Juliet into the story, and perhaps some of the unintended parallel to the present day. So, Chloe, perhaps it's best to start with the book's two central characters, Juliet Tsai and Roma Montagov. Who are they, what is their relationship, and how did they drive the story?
Ooh, wonderful starting question. So Juliet Tsai and Roma Montagov were originally written to, at the very basic core, represent two sides of a blood feud, because that was the story that I had the initial idea about, and then that was what I ended up wanting to be the very heart of what I was exploring. So in drawing them up, I had, you know, Juliet, who is very much a stand-in for the modern Asian diaspora. So she is native to Shanghai, but then she was sent away to New York when she was five. And then she came back again as a, like, younger teen for a year, which is essentially the flashback scenes of the book. And then she's sent away to New York again, only to return at the book's beginning when she's 18. And Roma Montagov, who is her former lover in that one year she was back, he is the heir to the White Flowers, who's the rival gang to Juliet's family business. And they're Russian emigres who came down after, well, they came before the Bolshevik Revolution, but they're very closely intertwined to, like, you know, the historical basis between China and Russia at that time. So he's very much like an immigrant to the city, and yet he knows the city almost better than Juliet does because he spent so much more time there. So in a way, these two characters are extremely alike because they have the same power as each other, like, as, you know, heirs of these two halves of a city. But they're also very, very different just in the ways that Juliet was raised, you know, away from the city and as an outsider somewhere else, having to grapple with the East and the West, and Roma being raised in the city, but as an immigrant, and having to deal with, you know, a certain heat, like the Russian immigrants have the same level of power as the local Chinese people of that time compared to, you know, the, imperialist West that was also playing a role. So, you know, with the whole, these two characters being the driving forces of the story, but they're also in intense conflict with each other. And I think that was what I was most interested in, like, when I was, you know, casting up these, like, two people who are going to lead the story. Like, how are they going to have to collaborate to drive the story forward? But then what is the drama between them? And how does that, like, set them aside? How are they in conflict with each other? And what else does it say about, you know, when are they opposed to each other, like, in their whole equal blood feud? Because that was what Shakespeare was, his whole thing, right? Like, two houses, both alike in dignity. And then when are they, so when are they opposed to each other in equal hatred? And when do they have to actually come together and fight against, you know, the colonizing forces that are both, that are oppressing them both?
So Juliet is a recognizable character in literature, right? I mean, she's a strong woman working to succeed in a normally male-dominated space. You know, I compare her to this book's version of Tybalt, Tyler. You know, what were your goals in trying to develop her as a character?
I definitely set out to make sure that she has these, like, traits that are very easily identified as, oh, like, you probably wouldn't expect that, like, in what you would think to be, like, 1920s historical fiction. I mean, I guess I'm historical fantasy anyway. But I set out to write this as a young adult book, right? Because I wrote it when I was 18 going on 19. And young adult fiction was mostly what I was reading to begin with. And it's really all I've even known, because I don't really see myself as an adult yet. So I'm quite unfamiliar with, you know, adult fiction. I'm growing more familiar with it as I age up. But I had grown up reading young adult fiction that was, like, really popular on the shelves. Things like, you know, The Hunger Games, Throne of Glass, The Mortal Instruments. And they all had these, like, feisty female leads that teenage girls really loved reading, because, you know, like, to a certain extent, stories are wish fulfillment, and you want protagonists that you can feel powerful when you are, like, going on this journey with them. But even though I really adored these books growing up, like, none of the protagonists necessarily, like, either looked like me or lived a life that I could, you know, necessarily relate to, because they were all white and I was, you know, an Asian girl growing up in New Zealand. So when I wrote Juliet, I wanted her to be someone that, you know, a lot of Asian diaspora picking up the book could be like, oh, this is really interesting. This book isn't about, like, being Asian, but she just happens to be Asian. And she has these core characteristics that we've usually come to expect from, like, the Katniss Everdeens of the book world. So that was kind of, like, the outward motivation I had going in to have a character who could provide that on the shelves, because that would have been what I really wanted to read when I was a teen reader. But also just in general, I like writing, like, protagonists that can throw a few knives around. I think it's fun for a story.
Right. And Juliet is in These Violent Delights is a nuanced character. I mean, her flaws ultimately, I think, perpetuate some of the core conflicts of the book, in addition to her strengths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
But I'd like to talk about the other central character, Roma Montagov. So what makes his character different from Juliet? One thing that you mentioned in your answer to my first question, which I hadn't realized until you said it, was you're right that he's an immigrant or from an immigrant family background, yet perhaps knows the city of Shanghai better than Juliet because he's been there for more of his life than she has. So maybe you could talk a bit more about Roma's character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in making the Montagovs Russian immigrants to begin with, it was very historically inspired, because it's been sort of left out of, you know, major historical, in major historical depictions of Shanghai at this time tends to leave out like how much was going on at that time. Because Shanghai was an open port city, like basically they didn't need the same sort of documents that a lot of other places had. There were so many different groups and, you know, people fleeing different things in their own countries coming into Shanghai. So the Russian population at that time was like enormous. There were so many of them. And there were really interesting power dynamics going on because of, you know, how many groups were there and how like the Western Europeans treated them and all of that. So when I was writing Roma, that was the background that it didn't necessarily affect the story in a plot sense, but it kind of colored the sort of world he came from. You know, as the heir to a rival gang that, you know, is trying to rule the city, he's allied to Juliet and that he is trying to hold on to power, but he doesn't actually want the power. And I thought it would be really interesting if Juliet was the more, you know, domineering type, while Roma is the type who, you know, at first glance, he has to be what people expect him to be, but he's actually much softer on the inside, which I thought would be like a really interesting contrast. So he doesn't like violence much, even though he does carry it out because he knows he has to. It's like the differences between, you know, what does family and what does responsibility expect you to do? And, you know, what do you actually want ultimately? He's one of my in terms of his characterizations, he's one of my like favorites that I have done because there's a lot to it. And I think a lot of it ended up being like small, like here and there lines that aren't necessarily like this big bang characterization, but there's just a lot about him that's simmering beneath the surface. And I kind of pulled that, I think, from like original Shakespeare's like Romeo, because original Romeo was so like, you know, melodramatic with his feelings, like feels a lot, feels like really hard. And I kind of wanted to put that into Roma Montagov, but, you know, fitted to this new world, like 1920s Shanghai that he has to survive in.
So let's talk about 1920s Shanghai a bit. I mean, so what you mentioned also earlier in the answer you just gave. So what makes 1920s Shanghai so interesting as a setting, and could you also maybe go into a bit more detail about the history of Shanghai during this time, and what's the city like?
To begin with, I think 1920 Shanghai was, I made the decision to set a Romeo and Juliet retelling specifically in that time period in that city. I mean, first, because I'm familiar with it, given that like all my relatives are from there. My parents immigrated from there with me like when I was young. So I had an idea about like what sort of like atmosphere, I guess, was like in the city at this time. So when I wanted to write a blood feud story and like, you know, two gangs battling it out and exploring all of like Shakespeare's themes about, you know, how does hatred like come forward and where does hatred end up, I thought it'd be really interesting to take this period in time where everything was essentially very lawless because the Opium Wars had just happened and Shanghai had been split into different jurisdictions between the imperial powers. So there was the French concession, which, you know, France controlled, and there was the international settlement, which the British and the Americans and the Japanese all had like a section of. And while China wasn't technically colonized at this time, Shanghai was called like a foreign city, like in its own country, right? So there were so many other imperial powers there that law and like legal order wasn't really a thing because it was very hard to actually like control people. Like when this section of the city had like this police force, other section of the city had this other police force. They couldn't like actually control what was going on, and it ended up being, in true history, it ended up being gangsters that was ruling the city. So while I do make up the Scarlet Gang and the White Flowers, which are the rival gangs in my book, they're very much based on the real life Green Gang at the time, which controlled like essentially the whole city, but they weren't like a tight knit group like the Scarlet Gang actually was. It was more like a bigger organization. But because the true history itself already was so interesting and like atmospheric to the themes that I wanted to address, I thought that it would match up like really nicely. Like, okay, I'll put rival gangs in here, and then I can talk about themes of hatred and how it carries out with equal groups in the rival gangs, and then how it actually carries out if there's a power dynamic with the British and the French. It was this world that had already sort of come like fully fleshed out of history, and then I thought, you know, this works for this new story that I'm trying to tell as well.
And so how much of the book really is rooted in the history of Shanghai? And I guess in what ways do the characters, the story, even some of the fantasy horror elements reflect the sentiments of Shanghai in 1926? I mean, of course, there wasn't really a monster in the Huangpu River, but what do those additions to the book, what did they reflect about the sentiments or the feelings of Shanghai in 1926?
Mm-hmm. I tried to root most of what I was, I guess, depicting in true history. While I made up a lot of the elements, like the rival gangs were made up, you know, a lot of the people obviously had to be made up, and there was no real monster. But in a sense, the made up elements were these. To get all English majory, the made up elements were these like physical manifestations of the like underlying horrors of the time, I guess. So, without spoiling it too much, there are these colonizing forces, and a lot of these worries from the local Chinese and the immigrant groups that are just trying to like integrate into the society about the, you know, what the British and the French are doing. But it's very hard to actually, you know, make that into a visible thread. You can't really see what's happening when, you know, imperialism is happening to a society until it's really happened, right? So with things like a monster rampaging the city as, you know, a topic for the characters in the book to talk about, and with things like an infectious madness that causes people to tear out their own throats, they were intended as like these physical representations of, oh, so what do these, you know, hard to speak about topics and intangible threats, how do they actually like manifest, and how can we dramatize it and really show, I guess, the harm of what was actively going on through, like, I guess, in a, you know, metaphorical sense, right? Because colonization isn't really like, it's not a passive force. Like, members of that society have to partake in it as well for it to be doing harm. So, you know, the madness was people tearing out their own throats, and a lot of links like that. They were very much reflective of, you know, commentary of what was going on, but also what continues to go on in modern day.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'd like to go a bit deeper into the idea of colonialism, imperialism. Obviously, tensions between the Chinese and foreign population in Shanghai is a major driving force of these violent delights. And I guess could you go more to about how you integrate these dynamics into your story and how the Montagoths, you know, who are white Russians and, you know, that's white in terms of their status as emigres from the Soviet Union, but they are also white. They're foreign, yet also more established than the other non-Chinese populations. I guess what space do they have in these dynamics?
Mm-hmm. It was all of that is very much pulled from true history, I think. So I would admit I don't tend to go like too deeply into this in the book, actually, because a lot of it almost felt like, you know, textbook recitation to me. I try to wind it in more as these things that you could feel like as characters talk to each other and like what characters are thinking rather than sort of explicitly stating it, because it was, you know, a lot of these things were hard to kind of see until, you know, a few years later when historians were making studies of it and really showing like the statistics of, you know, what was going on with these groups. So in history, white Russians were very much not seen as white people. And I think this has been it's been interesting to see how this book has been received in 21st century America, because I think America is so concerned with just looking at race as this whole, like, as the pinpointed determinant thing instead of the more nuanced outlook that 1920s Shanghai had, where it was more about, you know, ethnic divides, power divides, and all of that. So the way that, you know, historians tended to have like represented it is that white Russians were not seen as white people by the Europeans who were coming in. They were like, you know, lowest of the low, at the very bottom of the ladder, essentially equal in power to the native Chinese, which is why I ended up sitting a blood feud between native Chinese and white Russians in the first place, because of that historical backing. And then in the way that it kind of gets portrayed in the book is that it didn't feel realistic to me to actually have anyone really say that, because it's not something that what would have been like very cleanly like seen, right, or easily determined until you have that historical retrospect. It kind of more came through in the way that you can feel like what these characters feel. Like Juliet, when she's interacting with Roma, only has her personal grudges. She only thinks this is the boy that betrayed me and all of that personal kind of things. Whereas Juliet, when she's interacting with Paul, who is, you know, this British, I don't even know what word to describe him. He's not really a love interest because she never likes him. he's a British character who is trying to get her attention throughout the book. And when she's interacting with Paul, you can constantly feel this like underlying anger and an underlying sense of she can feel the power he can hold over her. So that was the way I was. It felt more, I guess, natural to represent like what was going on between the groups at the time and like how the characters like at the time would feel that.
Yeah, quickly on the character Paul, as you're trying to describe his relationship with Juliet, definitely every word I was thinking of would probably have involved some use of explicit language, which you can use on the show. So please feel free. But I have one more question about the historical setting. I know we've talked a lot about, you know, the setting of 1920 Shanghai. But I guess one more question on the setting, which is these violent delights, it features a few LGBT and queer characters. Mm-hmm. And how much does their experience, how much does that reflect, I guess, the reality of 1920 Shanghai?
Mm-hmm. So the problem is that when it comes to LGBT and queer history, a lot of it in historical records have been erased. So it is very hard to say how much of it is, you know, how much of it has accurately survived and how much we know now is true to what was going on at the time, because, you know, like as oppression happens, it tends to get brushed under the rug and erased. So while I wouldn't say that 1920 Shanghai was necessarily more open or accepting than anywhere else, right? I would imagine, you know, as all urban spaces are, as it happens when there are like a lot of people going on, as society is modernizing, there is a certain amount of acceptance. But I think my primary concern when I was writing in LGBT representation was that, you know, queer people have always existed through history. Like, that's not a question, even if we can't find much of the remnants left anymore. So to me, it was just more important to, you know, have them there because we know for a fact that they would have existed. And we know for a fact that, you know, people could live like that and live without sad, tragic endings that most media wants to go for. So it was, I guess you could call it like a modern insertion into it, because it wasn't so much as me wanting to like take, oh, what was, you know, true history saying, but more of, I think this is something that's important for stories being published in 2020. And that's what I will do, and put it into 1920 Shanghai because it's the story that I want to be telling.
So I'd like to shift now to talk about Romeo and Juliet, the play and some things, but I guess before we investigate the phrase that's included in your bio, my first question is, was it fun to find new and interesting ways to work in references to the original play? You know, I admit, for example, that I did not connect Roma's friend, Marshall So, to Mercutio until he gives a famous line at the end of the book, at which point I slap my hand on my forehead and go, oh my god, yes, of course. But I guess, was it fun to kind of find new and interesting ways to work in these references, these tropes, these themes into your novel?
Yes, absolutely. I've always really liked Shakespeare to begin with, even in high school, like, you know, even though I groaned with the rest of the class when we had to write essays and everything, I've always enjoyed the plays, and I really enjoy like the way Shakespeare uses language. So when I wanted to like reimagine Romeo and Juliet, one of the most fun parts was to see what I could pull from the story, how I could reimagine it, and then also just the little Easter eggs that I could drop. So there was like the larger sense of like, am I doing justice to the very heart of what Shakespeare is saying? But then there were like the smaller fun things where I was like, well, where can I put my favorite lines in the play? Like, where can I paraphrase it so that like the other like major super fans will recognize it and scream? And like, where can I make these allusions, and what can I, you know, sprinkle here and there to make it feel, you know, Shakespearean, like on a surface level as well as a like deeper core level. So there are a lot of, there are some lines where it is almost word for word from the play, but then I change the context of it. There are some lines where the context basically stays the same, like Marshall's last line, not last line, but like last line in the, in that final chapter. And, you know, all of that, it was just, it felt very English major of me.
No, it's great. As someone who, I'm definitely someone who, when I find a reference or Easter egg to a thing, to a work I recognize, I should note, it was definitely like, oh, that's cool. That's a cool that's a nice thing to see. I did want to quickly go into a line that's included in your bio, which is, you know, Romeo and Juliet is one of Shakespeare's best plays and doesn't deserve its slander in pop culture. I guess, could I ask you to explain that line a bit?
Yes, I love explaining this. I could go on and on. I really love Romeo and Juliet. Romeo and Juliet is definitely one of my favorite plays of his. And I think it's extremely well written, like on a craft level. It is just, there's so many great, like, fleshy ideas he puts in there. There are so many good lines. The end, like, ideas that he kind of ends with, like, you know, these two extremely young star-crossed lovers making their, like, final act of, like, I guess making their final, like, sacrifice towards each other, this act of violence, so that they can choose love instead of choosing, you know, the endless cycle of a blood feud. I think there's just something so interesting about what he was getting at. And when I say, like, the slander in pop culture, I think that Romeo and Juliet has kind of evolved to this point where Western literature has tried to either reimagine it or, like, you know, teach it poorly, honestly, if we're going to be honest. We've rehashed it so many times that people think that they know what the story is about because they've heard the references and they've heard the, you know, not entirely complete retellings rather than actually going to the source material, right? Because I would bet if you go up to anyone on the street and you're like, hey, what's Romeo and Juliet about? They'd be like, oh yeah, the two teenagers who, like, killed themselves, right? Blah. And I would bet that a much smaller percentage would say, oh, but I've actually read the play all the way through, I've actually gone to see a production. So my gripe about the Romeo and Juliet slander is I think it's become so popular that most people actually understand the, like, caricature of it, and they understand what other media products have falsely, or, like, not, they haven't, like, given it justice when they pull its ideas from it and then repackage it, you know, for their new audiences. To the point where I think people have kind of lost, you know, the appreciation for what was actually in the play. And I think if people actually go to the play, they would see that there's a reason why Romeo and Juliet has lasted so long and it keeps getting reimagined over and over again, because there was something just done so well about this, like, touchstone text of an idea that, like, really came so early about, right? So yeah, that's my gripe with Romeo and Juliet. I think more people actually need to go back to the source material than being like, oh, you already know what it's about. I don't need to listen to it again.
I know everyone thinks they know it. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you get this question all the time. But I think I know you're still in college. The trope is that aspiring authors quit their job for months or longer to write their novel. You, of course, don't quite have that option, I assume. So I guess what was your writing process like, and how were you, I guess, able to balance being a double major college student with writing this book?
It was very difficult. I won't lie. The good thing was that I drafted the brunt of it during one of my summer breaks. So I guess that kind of fits, you know, the taking time off thing, even though it wasn't, like, voluntary time taken off. It was just a natural break in college. But I drafted a lot of it during a summer break. So that was when the first draft kind of came to fruition. But by the time I'd, you know, gotten an agent and gotten the book deal, and then I was actually working on the book with my editor, which is really when most of it came to be, because I did some really heavy edits with my editor, basically rewrote most of it. That was during my sophomore year when I was taking, like, a really big course load. So That was really rough. But it was a lot of like really, really specific like calendar allocation. Like it got to the point where I had to stop blocking out my day, being like, okay, for 3 hours, I'm going to write my essay. And then for 3 hours, I'm going to like fix these chapters because otherwise I will not be making deadline and I cannot not make deadline. But then I was also like, I can't miss these essay deadlines. I have to graduate. But yeah, a lot of careful like timetabling. And then it also became like a matter of like prioritization, I guess, because, you know, like in college, like there's, you know, more than just academia going on. There's like school clubs. I had a job at the time too. And then, you know, just friends who want to hang out. So a lot of times I have to be like, okay, I will come hang out for 1 hour and then I have to leave. I have to finish writing this chapter. And then other times it was, you know, I have to stop doing this extracurricular club. It's just not manageable on my plate anymore. Or it's like, okay, I cannot do like part-time tutoring anymore. This is not viable. But, you know, like to get this book done, I had to make a lot of, you know, I guess sacrifices doesn't feel like the right word because it feels a bit too heavy. But like, I guess sacrifices that other college students would kind of just naturally be doing to fill their time with, because I ended up having, you know, an actual book too on my plate that I had to get done. But in the end, I survived and the book came out and everything was happy, even though I lost a lot of sleep. But it's okay. I'm young. I don't need that much sleep.
Yeah, as someone who also seems to be balancing about 8 different things at one time, I can very much sympathize. A couple more questions. So the book's core mystery is an epidemic of madness sweeping Shanghai. And you wrote the book, obviously, before all our lives were transformed by the events of 2020. Yep. But does the book seem different to you now after the COVID-19 pandemic?
Absolutely. Yeah. I really could not have imagined how much more relevant it ended up being. Because most of like a lot of people think that I ended up inserting things after the pandemic hit. And I was like, no, like a lot of these lines genuinely were written like 2019. Like this book had gone to copy edits by, I want to say like August of 2019-ish. So way before we even heard about COVID-19, just about all of the text was set in stone. So, you know, like there are certain lines in the book where it's like, avoid the madness, get vaccinated. And I'm like, no, guys, I swear I wrote this before the pandemic. But then there are like other certain discussions that come up in the book where I think it's a scene where Kathleen is near the Bund. She's trying to figure out what people have seen, like if these rumors about a monster causing madness is true or not. And she keeps getting waved away by the foreign workers in the like financial district. Like, you know, these fancy, you know, British expats working as bankers. They're ignoring her. They're like, we don't believe that there's a monster in the city. Please go away with your savage nonsense. And then there's this section where she's like, they don't believe that the madness is going to hit them because they think their riches are going to protect them. They think this is just something that hits, you know, the savage Chinese people. They won't know what's coming until it happens. And then a few chapters later, it happens. The foreign people start falling sick as well. So that, having written that, it was bizarre. Like when the pandemic, you know, it started in China and then America just wasn't taking it very seriously, right? You know, it was the Chinese disease. It wasn't American exceptionalism was happening. They're like, it's not going to hit us. And then it came and then it hit worse than it had ever hit anywhere else. So the parallels were kind of frightening when it was happening. And I guess I don't know what it ended up saying, really. I guess maybe it's just when I was writing it, I was trying to identify, you know, what is it that people think when they try to see a group of people as lesser than, and what happens when this threat seems like it's something that can't touch them, and then what happens when it does? Like, how do you reconcile that? So when it happened, like, in modern day, it was It was frightening. That's all I'll say.
So, last question before we wrap. When we're all allowed to travel again, if someone wanted to get a feel for the Shanghai you describe in These Violent Delights, what should they go see?
Ooh, love this question. The first one that comes to mind is there are a few scenes in the book that take place in Chonghuamiao, which is a place in Shanghai that's still around. And I would say it's one of the only places that probably still feels like it did in the 1920s. Like, you know, with a bit more Starbucks stores here and there. But it's the it's like the market section that kind of stems off the city temple, I believe. Either way, it's a major tourist destination. So anyone who does end up in modern Shanghai will probably hear of it. But it is definitely one of the places that would feel like it does in the scene, like where they start appearing in These Violent Delights. And also, I guess the Bund, these are all like probably major, these are major Shanghai tourist destinations anyway. But yeah, like the Bund, because they still have like the Art Deco buildings that were kind of being built in the 20s and the 30s. There's a scene where Romeo and Juliet run through Great World, which is this like, they call it an arcade, but even Juliet remarks it's not really an arcade. It's more like an amusement building. But in the modern day, it's kind of become like this weird art gallery. But either way, it's still like a cool little, you know, place to visit that would seem quite similar to what's in the book. And yeah, I guess in general, a lot of the major streets in Shanghai are still in the former French concession, and you can like see like the gated fences and like the trees that kind of tip over the roads in a sense, so that they will still have the like the same aesthetic as the like French concession scenes in the book. So all of those.
So. Thank you for listening to our interview with Chloe Gong about her debut novel, These Violent Delights. One actual final question. So, Chloe, what's next for you? And where can people find your work?
What's next for me? Next is the sequel to These Violent Delights will be coming out in fall of 2021. No release date yet, but that will probably be coming out soon because These Violent Delights is a duology. And I'll also be working on like a few, Shakespearean retellings before I leave this little niche, I think, because I'm really fascinated about like how I can retranslate a lot of these plays and drop all the Easter eggs and amuse myself. So I think I'm going to be doing that for a while as for what like people can expect from me. But you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, even TikTok under the same username at the Chloe Gong, or you can check my website out at www.thechloegong.com.
You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com. We hope you subscribe and continue listening to the Asian Review of Books podcast, now found on all your favorite podcast apps. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, and share us with your friends if you want to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Ed Caesar, author of The Moth and the Mountain, a true story of love, war, and Everest. But before that, Chloe Gong, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yay, thank you for having me.